best way of learning is to play. It was a game, basically. We have people writing code who are not engineers.
Right, right.
All of a sudden, right? And then asking how to get it deployed. And the way I've seen it is that within the organization, you've got about 10% of the team is incredibly driven to adopt new stuff, almost recklessly driven to adopt new stuff. Those agents are a bit like pets at this point. They're kind of cute to have around. You know, people know who they are. But over time, they'll kind of grow into being full colleagues.
Welcome to Secure Access with John Dillard, your front door to the future of compliance, security, and tech. Powered by Sign-In Solutions, we bring you bold conversations with industry leaders who are shaping how organizations protect people, data, and spaces. If you're serious about smarter, safer access, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the podcast, Richard. Thank you for taking some time to chat.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be on here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this because I think you and I had a chance to work together for a little less than 2 years. Maybe it was about a year and 2 months of overlap. Mm-hmm. And of course, we are separated by an ocean, so we didn't get a chance to spend a ton of time together. I'm excited to learn more things that I didn't have a chance to learn when we were working together. For that purpose, I love to start these conversations by asking you to just tell me a little bit about you. Like, what is the Richard Hill story? How did you get here? And you can start as early as you like.
Absolutely. So I've always been a jack of all trades. I've had sort of a fairly mixed experience, but I think the two things I've always had hand in hand has been a love of engineering and technology, but also of economics and finance and data and those sorts of things. Looking back through my career, my first job was working in the city doing financial technology for Morgan Stanley and for Citibank. At that stage, I was working credit derivatives in the run-up to the financial crisis. So kind of had a front seat view on the crisis as it took off. And, you know, I was sort of so interested in that, I thought, I want to understand this a bit better. Why is it the case that we have these credit derivatives that we can no longer sell, that the market has failed? You know, why is it the case that, oh, Lehman Brothers has just exploded and the automotive industry has been bailed out and all these Icelandic banks have exploded overnight and all the rest of it? You know, all these things were happening. I thought, I want to understand this a bit better. So I went back to university. I went to study again. I did a PhD in financial economics at Oxford to have the opportunity to understand more about the financial crisis and what I had been through at work. And then towards the end of my PhD, a friend of mine came and asked me for help. And he said he was running this software company called 10to8, and they were struggling to get their product out the door. And they thought, oh, well, Richard's a good engineer. He'll be able to fix this for us. So I joined as the CTO, Chief Technology Officer, in 2013. And it was a really interesting experience because they thought they had a product and a software issue. And they thought, oh, well, we'll be able to code our way out of this. And I sort of realized after a while, it was a cultural issue. It was a leadership issue. It was to do with communication and all these other challenges. The code was fine. They just weren't able to ship it. It's a very common story now, I realize, looking back at it. So we sort of rebooted a couple of times, iterated, pivoted, tried a few different things. And eventually, so I then transitioned from being CTO to managing director. So I took on a broader set of responsibilities, you know, overlooking sales, marketing and support as well. And we grew that company to successful exit with Sign-In Solutions in the end of 2022. And at that stage, you know, we joined this. I mean, it's a big change. I was used to being in a startup. At one point, there were just three of us and one of them was on maternity leave. So, you know, it was a small team doing really, you know, moving quickly and breaking things a lot. And then, you know, we grew to about 30 people. And then suddenly you're in a 200 person organization from, you know, that includes people such as yourself, John, from six other businesses. And that is a big shock, isn't it? You know, when you go through that transition. But it was very interesting. I mean, number one thing was a chance to meet people such as yourself, John, and the other entrepreneurs. And suddenly I discovered all those lessons I'd learned in running the startup were actually very common. Like everyone goes through these things, right? And everyone faced the same kind of challenges. And being able to compare notes and see who dealt with it well and who struggled with it was fascinating. I was amazed, actually, the mistakes I thought that we'd made, which how on earth did we make that mistake? And then I discovered that somebody else had done exactly the same thing.
Everybody makes the same mistake.
Exactly.
Sometimes they make the same two or three times. It's like, in my case, I tended to repeat them a couple of times before I figured it out.
So yeah,
that was the same exact feeling for me, that we got to get to know folks who had sort of shared experiences. And I do want to come back to your, when you joined 10to8, because one of the things that I think will be interesting to folks, I mean, there's the finance story and credit derivatives. Mm. And did you also study engineering at the same time? And that's sort of what pulled you into 10to8? Or, you know, was...
Oh, well... we do have to go back to primary school.
Well, obviously, like in my case, I was not a technologist myself. I just kind of had a lot of strange hobbies and ended up starting a tech company.
I was very similar. I mean, my dad was a software engineer, and he taught me to code when I was about 9. And my mom always says that I learned to read so that I could code. You know, I was a late reader. But when you write a computer program, you have to be able to read it and write it. So that's when I learned what, I think one of my earliest words I could read was print, you know, think from basic and that kind of stuff.
So just out of curiosity, why pursue the finance stuff was interesting, especially after what happened in 2008. But I guess the thing that I'm curious about is, you know, you obviously knew how to code way before most of us did. Was the idea always to apply that to finance, or how did you end up running down that path?
When I was at school, I had a very good economics teacher, and he had actually written a computer program to simulate a national economy. It was like a game, a computer game. And so he gave that to me. He gave me that code, and I created a new version of it that we could use in class so that all the students would be sitting at their own computers, and each one of them would be running their own country. And they'd be setting interest rates, and you'd be setting government expenditure and all that kind of thing. And all these economies would interact with each other. So if one person decided to raise tariffs on everyone else, that would then percolate through the model, and you'd see the implications for everyone else in the system. So it was a way of, I think the best way of learning is to play. It was a game, basically. And from that, you could get a very good intuition as to what would happen based on certain policies. So I was always sort of playing with software and technology, but also fascinated by economics. So it kind of came out of that, really. And then when I went to university, for my undergraduate, I studied economics and engineering, joint course, which is rather unusual in the UK. I know in the US, everyone kind of does that, but in the UK, it's kind of rare. So I had the opportunity of doing that. And that's when I then went to go and work in the city afterwards.
Okay, got it. Fascinating. That's something I didn't know about you. I'm learning that for the first time. So you finish up, you go to 10 to 8, you're getting the company in a spot to where, and you, as you mentioned, it was, you know, it was the code, but it wasn't the code. Now, that leaves you now at Sonnen Solutions, where I think you guys have been a part of the company for almost 2 years now, right? Is that roughly?
Oh, no, 2.5 years now.
Yeah. 2.5 years. I can't keep track. Yeah, time. So how has that changed your role? I mean, what are you working on now in the context of Sonnen?
Absolutely. So I was asked to take on a role in terms of pursuing advanced technologies, in particular AI, and its application both in operations. So how do we transform the way the company operates from engineering and marketing and support and everything else? The other side of it is using AI in the product. So what kind of capabilities does AI give us to allow us to provide features in our products that in the past were just impossible? When ChatGPT was released, when did it come out? November 2022, I developed the first AI-powered feature for what was actually at the time 10 to 8, just before we were acquired, in December over Christmas that year. And it was because the scheduling product, 10 to 8, sends a lot of emails, right? And a lot of text messages, because it's all about making people show up to their appointments. So, and people reply to those messages. So what do you do with the replies? And I had a sort of a brainwave that, hold on, we can actually process those ourselves. We don't just need to give them back to business. We can say, okay, well, what do you want to do with this? Do you want to cancel that appointment? Is that a 2 a.m. email from somebody saying, I'm really sick, I can't come in for my 9 a.m.? Do you want to free up the slot for somebody else, right? And having the AI handle that automatically. So we built that. We had that 2.5 years ago because it was feasible. And suddenly this entire new world of potential applications kind of opened up. And then, you know, we've added a number of other capabilities since then. In particular, I think the analytics is very interesting. So being able to ask a question and get a chart or get an answer is very powerful. And I think in future, it'll be kind of weird if you're using a product and you have to work out how to use it. Like you open a page in your product, and you're trying to work out, well, I know what I'm trying to do. Why can't I just tell you? Right? Why do I need to work out which button to press or which drop down to click? I just want to type in and say, give me what I want. And in future, that's how all products will operate. You know, the AI is going to be a substitute for the UI. That's kind of the way I see these things developing.
Yeah, that topic in particular is one of the threads I want to pull with you in another part of the conversation. Before we get to that, though, in terms of how AI is going to affect software generally, what has been your experience? And obviously, you were running a business that was delivering a product to a set of customers post-acquisition. You've now got this disruptive technology that requires the new company to adapt. What's the key thing you learned about deploying inside of Sonnen, leading these efforts that maybe surprised you a bit in terms of rolling out something that causes us all to rethink how we approach the problem in the first place?
Absolutely. Well, that's a very good question, John. I think it has been a lot more challenging because we're kind of used to being in an environment where we can release things and not have to worry. about implications. Whereas, of course, sign-in needs to be more careful than that because of our compliance requirements, the regulations and the standards we have to keep to hold ourselves to. And so that means there's more hoops to jump through. But at the same time, we have the capacity, we have the expertise to be able to do that. So there's a lot more knowledge and skill around that within the company that means we can then collaborate and make sure those things are delivered. So I think it's been, in terms of getting things into product, that is difficult because there's 1,000 other priorities as well. But when it lands, it's really delivered to a very high standard, to a very high quality, much higher than I did in the past when it was us doing it by our bootstraps. You know, I see the benefit to our customers. I see that they respond, you know, much more positively to that. They appreciate it when it does land, even if it does take a little bit longer.
Well, and continuing on the sort of internal sign-in experience of sort of being the person who's leading a lot of these things internally, one thing that I'm curious about is every employee in the company, obviously, over the last 2 years, their level of knowledge and expertise about AI has probably gone through the roof because literally everyone is using it all the time now for everything. How does that, I mean, that seems very different to me than so other technologies, you know, little things like how do you use software applications or, you know, it could be help desk applications where you might have some penetration in the company and some knowledge and people who are trying to stay on top of things, they generally are pretty good about knowing what trends are. It almost feels like everybody's moving just as fast as the development teams are in terms of their understanding and knowledge of what's possible with these things. How does that make this particular challenge different from your perspective? I mean, you're talking to a sales team and they're like, oh yeah, I've been using ChatGPT with or without permission. Hey, I've been using ChatGPT to build my sales scripts for months. What are you talking about?
Yeah. We have people writing code who are not engineers,
right.
All of a sudden, right? And then asking how to get it deployed. I mean, yeah, the biggest parallel, I think, is actually the web browser and the World Wide Web, right? So it was a new technology that impacted absolutely everyone. And some people try to say, well, there's companies that are web companies, and then there's traditional companies. And they try to draw a line between the two. It's like, no, every company is going to be impacted, but everyone has to have a website now. Everyone's going to have a computer with a browser on it. And the way I've seen it is that within the organization, you've got about 10% of the team is incredibly driven to adopt new stuff, almost recklessly driven to adopt new stuff. And they're the ones who have really grasped this. They've pursued it. They're pulling it in all sorts of different directions, and they've applied it to all sorts of interesting puzzles. Most people just want to get by day by day. They're interested, they're keen, but they also are used to a particular way of operating. So they want to continue operating in the day-to-day role and doing things the way they've done it beforehand, unless they have to change. And then there's some people, very, very few, who are actively resistant to it, right? And thankfully, I don't think I've really come across anyone like that. You get the occasional comments about people who are worried about it. And to be fair, you know, from a societal point of view, there are going to be big questions for us in future. But I think from a business perspective, like most people recognize, yeah, this is going to change things. So yeah. The challenge has been to sort of work out, well, how do you get those hyper-engaged people to share their best practice with everyone else around the organization? And so it becomes a question of dissemination of interest. So, you know, can we identify those key people in different teams? Can we empower them to talk to the rest of their teams and demonstrate new products? Can we get approval for new products and make sure we know what standards they have to meet in order for us to apply them? So those kind of things we've been sorting out over the past year. And now I think we're in a much better position than we were. I tell you, it took me about 3 months to get approval for ChatGPT. Right. In the early days, because there was concern about, well, what if somebody asks it to make a sales decision and it makes the wrong decision? Or what if somebody copies and pastes the output into an email without reading it and it says something defamatory or something, right? So we had to go through a few steps like that and say, well, listen, do we trust our staff? Yes, we do generally trust them not to screw up that badly. And if they do screw up that badly, that's just a performance issue in general. It's not about AI. And then we were able to separate that out. So we said, okay, we're going to allow these things. So yeah, those have been the big challenges, you know, getting us to bite the bullet, take the risk, but also to engage and get enthusiastic with those people who otherwise just want to continue in the way they operate day by day.
Well, taking a step back in general, and not just at sign-in, but I'd love to hear your perspective or obviously sign-in solutions, but also the customers that you're thinking about, organizations in general, because you're living with this problem every day. What the big pieces of change that organizations are facing are now? I mean, if we had to think about these things, like what are the big buckets related to how companies operate in general, especially as, I mean, obviously we've been spending a lot of time on LLMs, which LLMs are a huge piece of this, but, you know, agents and what agents mean for how we think about everything from how we software ops, but also how we make decisions, how we communicate. I mean, it's just all these different implications. What are the big buckets that you think are important for when companies think about this stuff?
Well, there's quite a few. I think the first thing is that a lot of people think of AI in the context of individual productivity, right? And so they kind of think, okay, we're going to use AI in writing code, and then we're going to have more productive engineers. We're going to use AI in our support desk, and we're going to reply to tickets more quickly. And they're thinking about like an individual. And that's, of course, going to be transformative. There's going to be a lot of disruption to people's roles over time. But I think there's a lot more interesting areas where organizations will structurally change. If you think about the Industrial Revolution, it wasn't just that we continued, you know, the old practices in more efficient ways. It changed organizational structure, right? It changed the way that people organized themselves. It basically invented capitalism, right? We kind of got a new economic model out of the change in machinery, right? And I'm not sure if that's going to happen with this stage, right? But I would say that it isn't just about me being a better engineer and faster at writing code. It's much more transformative than that. So I think one thing you mentioned, agents, right? A lot of the benefits of AI are found in sort of micro areas of people's work. So it's not the case that my job, I'm spending all my day doing stuff that could be automated. But there are certainly certain activities where there's probably 2 hours a week that could be saved if I had an agent with a particular speciality, and another 2 hours over here that could be saved by a different agent. So it's going to be like this kind of sliced up approach where there's lots of different types of agents with different skills that are able to supercharge what I'm doing. And that's how it's going to transform me. But it means that I am going to be playing a role in creating those agents, because I'm the only one who knows what those activities are, right? Me and the rest of my team. So you're going to end up in a world where teams are, in a sense, curating the agents that are working with them. And to begin with, they're going to be pretty basic. You know, Science Solutions, we've got about 30 of these agents now working across different activities around the company. Those agents are a bit like pets at this point. They're kind of cute to have around. You know, people know who they are. But over time, they'll kind of grow into being full colleagues, actually. I think they will become more and more sophisticated as the technology improves. And then you've got to think about, okay, well, what access do these agents have to our systems? Okay, so what data can they pull in? You know, I think you see this with a lot of SaaS products. A lot of SaaS products is just adding AI to their capability. So, you know Gong very well. You know, Gong has a very good AI system built into it, which can, you know, answer questions about deals and accounts. You've got a very good AI in Intercom called Finn, which is really good for answering customer questions. You've got, you know, AIs coming to Linear and other tools we use. But you end up in a world where you've got these tools and each one has an AI in it, right? And you know, when you're getting used to this, that's where you start. But when you use an AI that can actually access all these tools simultaneously, that's when it really becomes transformative. And so I've been, you know, using, we've got these tools inside Solutions now where you can have one agent that can access multiple tools to then answer a much bigger question. And so a really popular one at the moment is we have a lot of people writing these QBRs, quarterly business reviews, for our smaller clients, where they're using an agent that's been trained to understand, okay, well, what are the things that matter to our customers? And then it's able to pull data from, so let's say I want a QBR for customer X. It'll go read all the support tickets they've had. It'll go and read all the emails we've had with them, all the live chats on the website. And it's pulling this data in. In future, it'll even be able to pull in error messages from the product. So you can imagine a situation where it writes out a QBR and it says, the customer struggled with this issue for a while, right? But our support team in a different system helped to remedy it. And we released a bug fix, because that's in another system, on this date. And then they were happy again. And we apologized. And then we offered them a refund or whatever it happens to be. But because it's able to access all these different tools, it's able to produce a sort of enterprise quality piece of output for that customer, even though they're only paying you mid-market or small business style ARR. So I think that's when the agents get really powerful. They belong to a team with a specialized role, but they're also broad. They're able to access all these different tools to pull in data from loads of different places. So I think that really changes the way that organizations will operate. There's also the fact, going back to the theme about how it changes organizational structure, about how agents can help collaboration between teams. So to give you an example, we've got teams all the way around the world writing code on the same code base. And that becomes difficult because they're not in the stand-ups, they're not in the meetings with each other. They have met, we've introduced them, and they get along. But you know, when you're in New Zealand and Northampton, you have almost no overlapping time in the working day. So what people end up doing is they end up writing some code, hoping it'll pass review, waiting 12 hours, getting a one-line comment back saying, there's a problem with this, going another 12 hours around again, saying, oh, yes, sorry, that was a mistake. And what should take a day takes a month. Right? So the feedback cycle is so slow. And so what AI can really do there is to give you an agent that you can work against. What would my colleagues who are currently asleep say? So he can give me feedback iteratively and quickly. Most, basically what I'm trying to say is that, you know, AI will help, you know, when we talk about writing code, it may help an engineer write code twice as quickly or 10 times quickly, but they're not spending most of their time typing code. They're spending a lot of their time in meetings and reviewing things and giving opinions and thinking about things and all these other activities, especially when they're collaborating with people in other teams and other countries even. That stuff is really slow. And so speeding up those iterative cycles within the development process is just as important as actually writing, you know, churning out code more quickly. So AI agents that are able to sort of represent people who are currently asleep or AI agents that embody a particular goal that the team has decided upon, that's incredibly powerful because then I as an individual can work against that agent to get the quality of what I'm producing up to a certain standard. Not just code, it's also writing material for marketing. So that's going to be pretty transformative, I think. It's going to change the way a lot of organizations operate.
I mean, these are pretty fundamental things. The first thing I thought of when you started explaining this was, and you're an economist, so I'm guessing you possibly, there's a great book called Guns, Germs, and Steel that anybody who studies economics probably gets forced to read it at some point. But this idea, there are certain technological waves that fundamentally change the way that we interact, the way companies interact, the way people interact, the way nation states behave, the way we raise armies. I mean, that the reason why we have capitalism is some technological innovation made it possible, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And we probably are in one of those. And these are fundamental shifts in how we interact with each other. And one of the takes that I think I'm really interested in right now as it relates to SaaS, just as a student of SaaS software in general and SaaS tech, is that some of this is almost the end of how we think about software in general. And when you have agents or a single agent that basically is able to access every single relevant database or data store in any individual company, what does that mean for companies like Salesforce and Workday that have built everything around their UI and making data will be a UI? If that's not required anymore, well, what does this mean for software in general?
I think the first thing to say, it is certainly the case that the gap between being able to imagine a piece of software and having it in your hands is shrinking. So in future, you won't need to outsource to a third party. You could just code something yourself and have it up and running in no time. You could create a clone of Salesforce, a proper engineering team could create a clone of Salesforce in a few weeks. It really is not very difficult. Saying that, we have only written 1% or less than 1% of all the software that's ever going to be written, right? Because the world is actually woefully under-softwared, as it were. There are so many problems where we need more software. So there's a shortage of software at the moment, right? That's where I see it. Now, we now have a way of creating a lot more of it. So I don't think, you know, a lot of people are kind of worried about engineering roles and people losing their jobs and that kind of stuff. And that undoubtedly will be the case during the Industrial Revolution. You know, 80% of people lost their jobs because they all left, they stopped being farmers, right? And they went and worked in the cities, right? But that transition took 100 years and you know, people managed to cope with that. And we're going to see a similar transitions in the medium term as well as people, roles and industries change. But when it comes to software, the fact that software is now cheaper means we're going to end up buying more of it. Whether we'll need more engineers to do that or fewer, I'm not sure. I think it'll actually come out kind of a bit of both. There'll be changes over time. Certain types of software will boom. Other types of software will diminish. It's very hard to predict which way it's going to go. But I don't think it's obvious that all software is going to disappear. In terms of what it means from a business perspective, it does mean you need to work out where your value is. Because the value you're providing in terms of the software now, I'm going to tell you from my experience, we did have customers back in the days of 10 to 8 who cloned our product. We had a couple of cases of that, right? And they even sent us screenshots and it was a ripoff, right? Complete ripoff. And you know, the reason for that is because they were paying us a certain amount and they could reproduce it for 10 or 20 times that amount and they chose to do it. Right. So, you know, and that cost where the reproduction of the software becomes a feasible option is coming down. Eventually, you have to think, okay, well, what does that mean for our enterprise offering? Right. It means that you need to be offering a lot more value than just the software itself. You need to be thinking about your consultative thing, the data you're providing, the problems you're helping them to solve, and make sure you're tackling those, not just the provision.
I mean, we would talk about this all the time on the enterprise side of the business. And you try to coach the sales team, especially, like if you're talking about features of the product, you are probably doing it wrong.
No.
I mean, the features are means to an end. You probably should be talking about your customer's problems. And the more you understand your customer's problems, you're able to talk coherently about that, the more likely they are to trust you to deliver value against those problems. So in some ways, it just feels like an acceleration of exactly the same thing that we're saying. This intimacy with the customer problem is everything. And the features and what color the buttons are, and whether or not you have a drop down and what your fonts are like is, you know, yes, the product always needed to look great, but you know, the specifics of the widget are a heck of a lot less. The customers don't care, really.
No,
they don't really care about you or your product. they care about their problems.
They're buying a contract. They're not marrying you. They care about certain specific things, and they'll swap you out if they can. They're only paying you a lot of money because they get a lot of value out of you. And when that changes, then the contract changes.
Yeah, absolutely. Same. You touched on it briefly when we were talking about that, is that agents in any value chain begin to introduce some potential risks. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. You and I have talked about it a few times. Let me just start with asking you this. There are a ton of upsides for this that deliver value for customers. It's going to change the way we work in very positive ways and in ways that are uncomfortable. There are also some potential risks here for organizations to be thinking about. And I wondered if you could just give us your take on that to start.
Absolutely. I think the ones I'm most worried about at the moment are internal risks of AI agents, because I think that's where the most risk of an accident happening or a rogue actor within the organization. That's the biggest risk. I think in the future, it'll change to external risks of agents. So in the short run, the risks are things like leaking data, releasing information you shouldn't be releasing, losing control of the data boundaries within organizations, so data flows around. It's to do with decisions being made by agents not being vetted properly by humans and humans messing up. It's to do with those kind of accidental people building agents that they don't fully understand that then kind of go wrong. So just to expand on the first of those, I think one of the other really positive ways that AI is going to transform organizations is by really opening them up in terms of information and data transfer. So to give you an example of this, right, there are certain KPIs which, depending on the maturity of an organization, if you're lucky, you have a dashboard that shows you where you're performing. If you're less lucky, you get a PDF file emailed to you every couple of weeks with some numbers in. If you're really unlucky, you get to ask for something and once a month you might get it, right? Or you have nothing at all. Whereas what AI does, and by the way, the technical reason for this is AI is really good at translating English into SQL, right? It means you can ask an agent a question and it can go and query that database and build the world's most complicated database query in 2 seconds, run the query and give you the answers within 10, right? And that's the way the things are changing. It means that organizations that currently make decisions with very limited information are going to start making better decisions more quickly, because you're never going to be in a meeting again where somebody says, oh, we don't know enough about X. Let's put down an action to find out what X is. That will not happen because you'll just ask the agent. If you're in a board meeting and one of the directors asks a particular question, you should be able to surface the answer immediately, not wait 3 months until the next one. So that really is transformation, the way the companies make decisions, and also the acceptability of making decisions with incomplete information. They just won't be acceptable any longer. So I think, but of course, with that comes these risks. So, you know, the classic ones are things like, I'm an internist organization and I'm blackmailed by a competitor to download the customer database, or I'm in sales and I want access to all the clients so I can go and start selling to myself, you know, these kind of things internally. But there's also more subtle things. So, you know, a lot of these third-party AI services, they will actually use your data to train up their own models, right? And now, when you're using a SaaS product, if you're using Google Calendar, you generally trust that Google isn't selling your data to a third party, okay? And you can kind of trust them not to do that, more on the whole. And they might say, well, we delete your data after 30 days or after a year or something like that. But with AI, there's an additional leak. And that is, sure, they might delete the data after 30 days and they might not sell it. But if they use it for training their model, they've transformed it into a new form of data. It now lives in the model itself. And so there was an example of this we had recently where we found there was a note-taking application we were using. And they would train their models on your data, right? And so if you imagine that you had a call with a client and that client said, listen, we're laying off 20% of our workforce. Don't tell anyone. This, you're under NDA. We're telling you because it's safe and we need to renegotiate the contract. But, you know, just so you know, that's what we're doing. The AI, when it comes to training itself on that data, doesn't realize that sensitive information. It doesn't realize that that's commercially sensitive. It's a fact that makes the model better at answering questions about what that company is up to. So it absorbs it and it potentially regurgitates it to somebody else. But John, you remember the story about ChatGPT recommending people put glue on their pizza? It's because the AI didn't realize that was a sarcasm. Somebody wrote that in a Reddit post and the AI thought it was true. So it learned it. And it doesn't know necessarily that something should be learned from and something shouldn't. It just soaks it all up. You simply say to the supplier, don't train your model on our data, please. And most of them do. Most of them have that guarantee, but not all of them. So it's always worth keeping an eye out for.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, facilities, visitor management, the kind of customers that you deal with every day, what are some things you worry about for them specifically because of their use cases around people? And I mean, obviously they're doing identity checks, that they're physically moving people in and out of the spaces. they're tracking their movements inside the spaces. What are the things that are unique to that market space that you think are important for your customer set? Because that's one that's, well, you know, there's an interaction between the physical and the virtual here.
Absolutely. And that comes back to the point I made earlier about AI is accessing all these different systems. So if you think about your warehouses, your offices as part of your infrastructure that you want to monitor and understand, it's another tool, right? It's another tool that the AI can kind of interact with to understand how the business is operating. That's wonderful for several reasons. You know, if you're worried about capacity planning across sites, you have a reception area which is getting too busy. You have an agent that's able to forecast, predict when that's happening because it also has access to your calendars. So we're linking the virtual to the physical. You're able to make better predictions, better preparations. It can spot patterns. So imagine if you could read every bit of information flowing through your visitor management system yourself and kind of cross-reference it and check it all yourself. There's far too much. You wouldn't be able to do it. But an AI can, and that can then spot these kind of patterns that would make you think, something fishy is going on there. How come three different people have all signed into different locations, but they all have the same number plate on their car? That's weird. Either there's something fishy with the car or those three people are actually the same person under different identities, right? Now, if you notice that, you might do something about it, but you're not going to do that because you don't have the time. You've got better things to do, right? But when it comes to AI and visitor management, it can absolutely spot those kind of patterns just by keeping an eye on everything. So there's lots of applications where if you give AI access to your visitor management system, but also granted access to all the other sources of information within your organization, you can spot these patterns that otherwise would go amiss. And so that's forecasting for the future, planning for it, and also spotting risks. Another sort of pillar I should mention of the visitor management sort of system as we see it is also the visitor's experience. So, you know, when a visitor is coming on site and they're going to a new site, a site they've never been to before, they don't know what it's going to be like. And so we have tools, an AI assistant for that visitor that can answer their questions, help them understand anything they need to know and make that visit as pleasant as possible. So that might be, for example, where do I park? Is there parking? Do I need to get there early? Because the car park's actually a long way away from the building. You know, are there roadworks going on? Are there things I should know about before I get there so I can plan ahead? And so these are kind of questions you might ask a receptionist if you had time and if you thought about them. But an AI agent can kind of say, he's not been here before. I better warn him about the parking, or I better warn him about the roadworks that are going on. And it can do all that stuff automatically and intuitively.
Well, you're getting we talked a lot. Obviously, when people think about risk in general and AI, they tend to think about, you know, people stealing data, people doing bad things, and physical threats too. Underappreciated is probably brand risk. It's interesting that you raised the experience question, because on a couple of podcast guests that I've talked about, we spent a lot of time talking about the visitor and security teams being the ones who really are the first brand experience for most of these companies. And that's specifically related to visitor management, is this idea that if you don't get AI right, or if you misuse it, the potential damage to your brand as a great partner, it could be for a customer, it could be for potential employees, they come in and they just have a rotten experience at the front desk because they either don't have AI at all and they expect it, or they do have AI and it's terrible, or it doesn't access the right data, or it provides the wrong data because it's not configured correctly. What are your thoughts there?
Oh, well, it's a huge risk. I mean, and that's why a lot of companies are choosing not to do anything about it at all, because they'd rather not. they just think if we stay out of it, we'll be safe.
Different kind of risk.
Absolutely.
You still get one. It's a different one. Yeah.
Yes, but, absolutely. Absolutely. I'll come on to some other examples later, actually, where not using AI is the most risky thing you can do. But no, when it comes to that visitor experience, if you think if it's a commercial business and those visitors are customers, right? Well, if they want to book with you and they can't because there's no AI assistant to help them, then they'll go somewhere else. Right? So you're losing business through that. You know, if you arrive at the reception desk and the receptionist doesn't know who you are and doesn't have any of your paperwork and leaves you waiting. I had an experience actually just last year with my son going to hospital for surgery, in fact. And we arrived outside the ward and they left us waiting for an hour in the waiting room. Finally, they let us into the ward because they had the bed ready and we waited there for 6 hours. And then they came around and said, oh, we're terribly sorry. We didn't realize you were here. Our systems hadn't logged it properly, and the surgeon had actually been looking for us and couldn't find us within the organization, right? So they then did the surgery first thing the following morning, but they also told us, and this is just crazy, they said, don't leave the hospital. It's best if he sleeps here, because then he won't lose the bed.
Oh my gosh.
So you end up with these situations where you're forcing people to fit into your process, into your system, as opposed to having the system flex and respond to their needs. The fact that they had no idea where we were is ridiculous, right? The fact that we were in a hospital and they didn't realize we were in a hospital. We could have been anyone. right? And so AI helps to sort of tie these pieces together. You need to get that information when they cross the threshold. You need to know who that person is. You need to know where they are. Which bed do you allocate them to? That data needs to be available. I mean, it's not private, to the surgeon. That needs to be available to the care team, to all the employees and that sort of thing to provide that service properly. In our particular example, the person on the ward was ringing the other ward, the other department to work out what was going on. Nobody picked up the phone. And that was the breakdown in communication. Whereas if they were able to access an agent that had access to the database, they could have queried it and found out straight away that there was something wrong.
Yeah, this is really interesting because a thing that feels like is a little lost on companies that are either adopting slowly or are reluctant to adopt at all, they really lean into the technology, failing to understand how rapidly market expectations are shifting. I mean, if you're interacting as a customer or even as an employee inside of a company, if you're interacting with the company systems and data, it's almost like a perceived competence like you would think about another employee of the company. Like if I talk to somebody at a company and they are incompetent because they don't know the answers that I think that they should know, I'm going to think this company employs idiots. I'm not going to do business with this company. And if that agent is almost like an avatar for, I mean, especially as they get more capable, you expect the technology that you interact with at an organization to be competent. And that competency is rapidly growing. So that you do business with companies that are very good at it. If you then go to another company, Company B, and they haven't properly deployed agents, integrated the right data, provided the right experience with those agents to solve the problem, whether it's coming in to visit or finding a parking space or knowing where the patient is. And that's a real financial and business risk. It's the same risk that you might have if you hired terrible employees.
Absolutely. A lot of these risks are actually kind of, they already exist with just incompetency and poor coordination. The other thing I'll add as well, actually, by the way, is that in a lot of organizations, you often can't get data, not because people are incompetent, it's because they don't want to share it with you, right? I mean, if there's a KPI that shows that my team is underperforming, I'm not going to release that. I'm going to drag my feet as much as I can. So, you know, you can imagine agents are able to run these queries and, you know, open things up, completely changes the game. They're, you know, there's nowhere to hide. In that regard.
Yeah. But also, it changes expectations for transparency for sure.
Yes.
Because if you don't answer questions, people kind of know you're full of shit. Yeah. Well, not anymore. Okay. The excuses are shrinking.
Absolutely. And the excuses for delaying and dragging your feet are just disappearing. So, yeah, that's why I think, as I was saying at the very beginning, I think organizations will be transformed institutionally and structurally as much as individual roles will be.
Yeah. Yeah. Neat. Well, coming back to a different part of the risk, possibly the scarier one. And this is where, just because of the kind of guests we have on the podcast, we tend to talk about scary things. One of the things, and I know you spent a lot of time discussing the internal risks here, but as it pertains to external risk, I gave a talk that I think you saw last year where we got into agentic risk specifically and the sophistication that's possible because of adaptation specifically. I mean, the thing that I think about is, you know, you think about visitors, for example, in sign-in. Obviously, there's a person who's maybe they're trying to come into a facility that they're not allowed to come into, or maybe they're trying to access data that they're not allowed to, or there's a security protective component to what Sign-In Solutions does. You know, humans can adapt in real time so that it get challenged at the gate. They can sort of make up a story and change their mind or try a different attack. Technology, you really couldn't do that until like last week. The cyber attacks for the most part were they were pre-written. They were like, you know, stuck. We have a specific mission. We're going to go execute that. And if you could figure out how to get in the middle of that chain, you could stop the attack. What if the agent can change the tactics as it's attacked, right?
Absolutely.
And integrate with physical actors on the outside. I'm curious if you've given that some thought, if customers are talking about it, what agentic AI means in terms of both physical and virtual threats to your customers or companies in general.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it means that you need to be much more careful. Well, first thing is, if you ever open up a company corporate firewall and you look at those logs, okay, and you see the kind of attacks that companies are undergoing every second, it's terrifying, right? But thankfully, most of those attacks are following a playbook process. You see the same kinds of attacks repeated over and over again. It gets terrifying when agents can respond and react. They realize, oh,
geez, playbook in real time.
Your firewall is running this software. Your systems are built with this infrastructure. I'm going to use that knowledge. I'm going to remember that. And I'm going to find cracks in the armory of your defenses that maybe individually wouldn't allow me in. But once I've worked out enough of them, I'm going to find my way through. And there was a really nice example of this quite recently where people used an AI agent to find a security bug in the Linux kernel. a zero-day remote exploitable security hole, which allows people to hack into computers remotely. And that was just found by AI, just searching the code. It had to read 10,000 lines of code. It worked out. So now when you're thinking about, you know, it sort of accelerates and opens up a whole new range of attack vectors. When you're thinking about people coming on the site, are you going to take it for granted that the person you spoke to over the phone is the same person who has just walked into the lobby? Okay.
Right.
Because that voice that you heard on the phone could have been anyone, right? With voice cloning technology and AI models there, I've had to tell my parents, if, you know, ever get a phone call from me, ring me back on the number that you know that I have first, just to make sure that, if I'm asking for money or something like that, because you only need, we have enough audio in this podcast to now clone both of our voices,
it's
right?
Well trained.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got to be very, very cautious on that sort of thing. Imagine that your employees, the kind of phishing and social media attacks you can do on people nowadays using AI is terrifying. You could, for an organization of 1,000 people, find the 2 employees in that organization who are most blackmailable, most bribable, from monitoring their social media, from monitoring their LinkedIn, using AI and sort of gauging sentiment on their posts. You identify that chap's having an affair, or this guy isn't happy with the boss or whatever, and you know who to target, right? So you can no longer live in a world where you can sort of say, we have a corporate boundary and that boundary protects us, because there will be people within the boundary who are bad actors as well. And if you were to ask somebody, you have a 10,000 person company, what's the probability? John has talked a lot about risk being probability multiplied by consequence. So what is the probability that none of your employees are bad actors? Right?
If you're... I'm not even sure we get there on this podcast.
I mean, if somebody says, oh yeah, I'm certain, we vet employees when they start. Okay, great. When you've hired them, you vet them. What about later? What happens to them? People go through life changes and that can make them more vulnerable. So you need to act as if there are these risks. And that means, okay, we need to spot patterns. Okay, this employee normally works at this site, but recently they've been signing into these other locations unexpectedly. This employee's been having a large number of interesting visitors to come and see them who are not from our normal suppliers. What's going on there? Why did this employee who normally never goes to a warehouse suddenly show up at a warehouse? They use their access permissions to get in, but that's a bit weird, isn't it? So all of a sudden, the physical reality of the world meets the sort of the messy nature of human beings.
I love that you're blending these things together. I think Sanyan is doing a great job and is a good position to be in, because a topic that comes up over and over again with guests on this podcast is the arbitrary distinctions between different security disciplines. You've got this sort of cyber security thing, which people get degrees in it and then they want a job in it. And then that's all they want to work on because, that's where they think the money is. And it doesn't occur to them that the things that you're describing, like physical patterns of movement, where they sign in, what visitors they have, what times of day they're coming in and out of a facility or crossing the corporate physical boundary, might not be interesting by themselves, but when combined with other patterns of data that you're seeing on systems are important. Well, if those two teams never talk to each other ever, because the cyber people think that the physical security people are not cool, you have a very big problem, right? I mean, how do we fix this? How do we get these teams to stop? And the same thing, by InfoSec is a different discipline. Personnel security is a different discipline. You've got HR that thinks it owns all of the bad information about the human beings and their individual backgrounds, and they're not sharing that. How do we tear down some of these barriers in order to help companies better adapt to the very rapidly changing risk environment?
It's a really difficult problem that, all the people that you've mentioned play a role in fixing, right? We have to, organizations are grown in a particular way for particular reasons, but the development of technology and the way that AI can help solve these problems means that those silos no longer need to exist in quite the same way. So while you may have speciality, I'm an expert in HR because I have certain skills, I can still interact with an agent that is able to distill and explain to me other aspects of the organization in a way that I can understand. I don't need to be an expert in, cybersecurity. If I wanted to just ask this individual here, have they shown up on social media or have there been any news reports about this individual? I don't want to have to go and talk to another department to come work that out. The AI agent is able to distill, pull across from lots of different systems and summarize that for you in language and tone that you understand based on your skills. So I think those silos, They need to be broken down. And the other part of this is friction. There's a lot of places where people would do the checks. They would ask the questions, except it takes like 2 weeks to get an answer. There's another team that they're physically in another building. There's a different reporting structure. And when they don't get back to you, the only common person in the org chart is someone way, way too high that you're never going to bother with this particular problem. So you just let it drift. You just let it slip, right? AI agents there can, like I was talking earlier about, agents that can represent other people while they're off sick or while they're away. Agents that you can speak to as if they are an expert in one of those areas, able to distill that information and summarize it for you. So I think there's certainly a lot to be done. The first part of this is to make data available, to get those agents built, and to get them wired into those systems.
And so, I mean, the technology, the threat is the remedy to some extent. I mean, the same technologies that the actors are probably going to use to thwart us are probably best countered by the same technology. So yet another reason not to drag your feet and figure
well,
out.
Well, exactly.
Stick your head in the sand.
Going back to the earlier point about the security vulnerability found in the Linux kernel, that is a great example of where the only real solution is to use AI in writing the Linux kernel in the first place, right? You have to be using it because it found a mistake that humans have missed. So if you're not using AI to elevate your own skills, you're not going to be able to write the code that is not going to be vulnerable to other people. And I think if you're not, you know, I have seen this where companies say, we're not going to use AI because, oh, we're worried about copyright infringement or something silly like that. I'm like, well, okay, if you're not, those bad actors who are trying to get into your network, they'll eventually win. They'll do it because they're going to be operating 1,000 times faster than you are with your handwritten artisan code.
So, well, and this is a really good segue into a, you know, mitigation strategy that as it comes back to some extent about the organizational changes that this technology is driving. I mean, what does this mean for leadership? If you think about, you know, CIOs, chief security officers, VPs of engineering, but not just those folks. How do leaders need to be thinking differently to bring their people along? How does this affect personal executive leadership in companies?
So it's a big challenge. There's a few issues that I think executive leadership have that makes it difficult for them sometimes to adapt. One is that to an extent, delegating legal decisions to legal experts and compliance, there is a bias for risk aversion. And so you see some companies where they will say, this is a new unknown. We don't understand this technology. So let's imagine the worst case and act upon that. And the worst case is that the AI steals all your data and runs amok. Okay, we're not going to use it. Whereas the other companies that sort of say, we're going to just assume yes. We're going to have a bias for yes until we have a good reason otherwise. And then they may prohibit some tools because they're found to be unsafe. But generally speaking, they are going for with a solution first. But I think that is a massive mind shift. Like a lot of people really struggle with that change. The other thing is, I think that it's important for executives to actually use the technology. Like I mentioned earlier, the agents have the capacity to open up data, to surface insights, to do analysis across a wide range of systems, and to break down the barriers between teams and departments. If the executives aren't using the tool to do those things, they're really missing out. If they delegate that to somebody else, be like people who still get their emails printed out for them by their secretaries, right? They're missing out on the benefits of the technology. And, you know, they should just go in and ask questions. And then the other part about it is these agents are incredibly responsive to any direction you want to take that conversation in with the agent. And so an executive can ask some fantastic questions. And I've seen this because we have our agents and we can monitor the performance of them. And the executives ask the best questions. They ask the tough ones, the ones that challenge the agents, if they ask them. But then others don't ask questions at all. So you're trying to say, well, give it a go, try it out, see how it goes. And so that's been a challenge as well. But I think executives who are used to playing a political game with data, they're going to really struggle in the future because the data is being opened up.
Yeah.
Right? The silo is being broken down and they need to be ready for that. And if they don't respond to those challenges, well, their competitors will. And the competitors, like I said at the very beginning, will make better decisions with better data more quickly than they will. And they'll get outmaneuvered.
That's excellent advice. Going a layer down from those folks, that makes a ton of sense to me. And to some extent, we've already talked about what line individual contributors can do to maximize use of technology. The folks who are in the middle, and I'm talking about specifically middle managers here, the ones who previously were the ones who were responding to the executive request for data that maybe they can just get themselves. And they're also not actually building themselves or, you know, they're not involved in the builder class of these companies. How do they protect themselves against what is likely to be a pretty tremendous disruption for them? The information broker layer in many companies. How do they keep themselves relevant and adapt to what's coming?
That's a great question, John. So I think the first thing is they're actually the people who are best positioned to create these agents and to create AI, because they're the ones who they have the practical understanding of what's happening day to day, enough of that, but they also, you can see enough of the bigger picture, the strategic vision for the organization. And so they're actually able to create those agents that will get adoption. They will actually provide value. So I think they're key. Those guys, getting engagement with them is absolutely vital. And it's funny you mentioned Guns, Germs, and Steel, because there's an anecdote in that book about the development of writing as a technology. I'm pretty certain it's in Guns, Germs, and Steel, where these Native American Indians come across a stagecoach that's been abandoned in the desert. And they don't have their own written language. They speak, but they don't write it down. But they find a book in the stagecoach. And they open it up and they find all these weird symbols inside. And they're like, well, what the hell is this? They take it back to their tribe and they realize, they work it out. Okay, this is writing, right? They sort of discovered writing from this book. So they then use the same symbols to write down their own language. But because they never met anyone who spoke English, they gave each symbol a different sound. So they end up with a sort of a parallel writing system. But what that story really illustrates is that sometimes you just need to be exposed to something and a good example of it, and then you can adopt it yourself. And then it doesn't feel like it's being forced upon you. I think if you have middle managers, people who are in positions of leadership and running teams, and they see other middle managers who are excelling with their teams and introducing artificial intelligence, they will be much more likely to then adopt that for their own teams and to apply it in a way that makes sense within their context. Because it's not going to be the same as everyone else. You can't have a uniform approach to this. Everyone's going to be making little agents for little tasks across the board. And those people who are in those teams will know what those agents can and should do. You can't mandate it. That doesn't work. And so instead, you can make tools available. You can make agents available. You can make finance and budget available. But then you need to leave those middle managers are the ones who are actually going to drive change.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Well, this has been an awesome run. I like to close out with a few rapid fire questions.
Richard, oh, yes.
That I have not run by you in advance. So hopefully you can find it. Gotcha. The first one is, this is easy. The worst AI opinion you've heard this year. The dumbest take.
Oh, my word. Well, there's one that comes up fairly often, which is that artificial general intelligence is just around the corner, but also that AGI is necessary to transform the world. So in my view, as AI is developing, that we have the tools. If AI stopped developing today, for some reason we hit some ceiling on the development of the technology, it would still be transformative.
Operationalize what we have. Yeah.
We haven't actually, yeah, there's a bigger gap between where we've used this and the potential. That gap is still massive. AGI, you know, being necessary for us to transform the world. No, it's not. We're already there.
Biggest missed opportunity for organizations that are delaying adoption?
I'd say the biggest missed opportunity, I think, for those organizations is training their employees and exposing it to them, because it's going to be career changing. So those organizations are literally wasting their employees' time, and those employees need to be learning about the new technology. That company will fall behind and maybe we'll have to lay people off, and those people won't be skilled up. And that'll be an enormous waste of human talent. So I think that's why I'm very proud to have the role that I have in Science Solutions, because I have the opportunity to quite literally help people transform their careers, not just the organization.
Got it. Biggest misconception about Oxford PhD graduates that everyone should.
So they're all really smart.
I think you're perpetuating the stereotype, Richard.
Is that intelligence and character are always positively correlated. And I don't think they are. I've met some very bright people who are not very nice. And so, you know, you've got to be careful. When you're judging somebody, I will take somebody who's a good character over somebody who is super smart anytime.
Awesome.
So, yeah, that's what I'd say.
That's a great take. I love it. All right. Well, I'm going to give you the last word. I guess the ending question that I'd love for you to share with everyone is parting thoughts, the one thing that you want everyone to take away from this conversation in case they didn't listen carefully. Closing ideas.
Well, closing ideas. One is, if you're not trying AI, try it. If you have a problem that you're used to solving using your brain, try throwing it as an agent and see how it gets on. This stuff is very scary occasionally, and I have had moments of existential angst by this, right? There have been times when I've seen a technology and I genuinely thought everything I've been doing since I was 9 years old has been a waste of time, right? And that is scary, right? And so there's a degree of that, and I'm a little worried about what will happen with society. We'll have to navigate that over time. But at the same time, there's so much potential. When we think about these one thing I didn't mention earlier is in terms of those cybersecurity risks, those agents you now have that are trying to hack into your system, right? The ones that respond, the ones that change their behavior, they act autonomously. These agents have 100 kilobytes token ranges at the moment. That's their context window size. If those were bytes in a computer, this would be like a ZX Spectrum trying to hack into your network, and it's doing it really well. We're comparing it to a computer 30 years ago. Think about where these AIs will be in 30 years' time, when right now they can't even read a whole book. But they don't fit in the context window. So you can't ask it to summarize a novel, right? But in future, we'll be able to. And just think about how much, you know, what the risks are associated with that. And that's why I mentioned earlier, the external threat is going to grow with time, right? But at the same time, there are defenses. And these defenses primarily also consist of AIs. So, you know, we can fight fire with fire. If you're worried about AI agents that are trying to hack into your systems, that are trying to blackmail employees, that are trying to circumvent your security processes, AI agents can also do a great deal to help you remedy that and modify that. So if you're worried about a bad actor inside the company trying to access systems they shouldn't be accessing, and these patterns of behavior, it is now much, much easier to create AI agents that can monitor and detect that than it was beforehand. And that's the saving grace. That's the reason why we shouldn't be worried about this, but we do need to act.
Excellent. All right, Richard, that's fantastic advice. It has been an absolute delight talking to you today.
It's been wonderful catching up with you again, John, as well.
I've learned so many new things about you. I can't even keep track of what the hell. It's fantastic. But I do think this is one that everybody will enjoy and will be a lot smarter if they hear.
So thank you for sharing your experience
with everybody.
Thanks for joining us on Secure Access, brought to you by Sign-In Solutions. If you found today's conversation insightful, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. For more on transforming compliance, security, and workplace experiences, visit signinsolutions.com. Until next time, stay secure, stay informed.